Welcome to episode 154 of The Far Middle, and we land at the start of May, probably the best all-around month of the year, in your host's humble opinion. The theme for this episode is going to be, in a word, consistency. Or to expand from a word to a phrase, to be more specific, a lack of consistency. We have a storyboard and string of connections this week that highlight how lack of consistency is becoming a norm in our society, from the superficially interesting distractions to the biggest of issues affecting all. And that's not a good development. It's something that stands to get worse and lead to big problematic symptoms if we don't start to pay attention and demand simple consistency. Let's kick off with our sports dedication, one that ties in early May when baseball is getting into full swing, pun intended, and our episode theme of lack of consistency. MLB is offering up a current example that everyone's talking about. I speak of the gambling controversy involving the biggest name in Major League Baseball, Shohei Ohtani of the LA Dodgers, who's the $700 million man and the highest paid athlete in the history of America. Now, I remember when there was the $6 million man on TV, shout out to Lee Majors, but I guess that's peanuts these days. First, the baseball rule on gambling, it's very clear and well known. MLB Rule 21, enacted back in 1927, says that players, managers, umpires, or club or league officials, they face suspension for betting on games in which they're not connected and for placing bets on an illegal bookmaking business. Now, as for betting on games in which they have a role, they face permanent banishment. The way Major League Baseball is handling the Ohtani situation, it's quite different than how they handled a prior Far Middle sports dedication subject and one of your host's favorite players, although not one of my favorite people, Pete Rose. There's a huge lack of consistency here with MLB when dealing with the biggest of hot-button topics, gambling, and its biggest stars during different eras. Let's compare and contrast. And we start with today and Ohtani and his betting scandal. And his interpreter-slash-companion, Ipe Mizuhara, which is an unfortunately ironic first name, Ipe, considering the circumstances that he finds himself in. The vibe surrounding the interpreter, Mizuhara, got weird after he claimed in an extensive interview that Ohtani had been aware of money transfers made from his, Ohtani's accounts, and in his name, to an illegal bookmaking operation, like as in over $4 million of money transfers. Now, Major League Baseball at that point had to be thinking, holy crap, this is Pete Rose and his mess on steroids, pun intended. But wait. Then the interpreter retracts his comments from that interview, and a new spokesperson for Ohtani, the player, disavowed the interpreter's original statement and story. And Major League Baseball changed their stance on this controversy within days as well. Something smells fishy here, don't you think? Maybe making things up as we go, perhaps. Everyone, Ohtani, Mizuhara, the Dodgers, and Major League Baseball, they all drastically changed stories or positions, sometimes by the day. You can't keep up, and considering I'm recording this about 10 days prior to airing, I'm betting there's a good chance official stories have been tweaked once yet again. The last official, honest this time it's the truth, version that I have at the time of taping this episode is that Ohtani himself was saying that he had, using his words, never bet on baseball or any other sports, and denied ever asking anyone, again using his words, to do it on my behalf. He said that Mizuhara was stealing money from his account and telling lies. And again, quoting Ohtani, up until a couple of days ago, I didn't know this was happening. He has a new interpreter, by the way. And I chuckled when Ohtani said at his news conference, when he took no questions, by the way, that, quote, I'm glad we had this opportunity to talk. Yeah, right. I'm sure he was glad about that. I see no details on how over $4 million was stolen from Ohtani's bank accounts. And yes, Major League Baseball opened what they called a formal process investigating the matter, whatever that means. And though the feds, they're drilling down into this alleged bookie too, so I'm sure this isn't the end of the story. Now let's shift to how Major League Baseball handled the Pete Rose betting crisis 35 years ago. In early 1989, before those Sports Illustrated articles detailing Rose's gambling appeared, the Cincinnati Reds and Major League Baseball invited Rose to come to New York City for a secret meeting. Outgoing baseball commissioner Pete Uberoth, incoming commissioner Bart Giamatti, and his deputy Faye Vincent, which is the to-be future commissioner, all three of them were there. And when they asked Rose if he had ever bet on baseball, he denied it. It's Pete Rose, after all. But that's what everyone wanted to hear, just like what Otani changed his story to. As Rose left that day, everyone felt good. And when the media found out about the meeting, Ubaroth said, "There's nothing ominous," it's using his words, and he was also quoted as saying, "and there won't be any follow-through." But Major League Baseball knew there was a potential problem. So Faye Vincent, he lobbied to have Major League Baseball conduct their own investigation, and the Pro League tapped a guy by the name of John Dowd to run it. He worked at the Department of Justice, and he dealt with tricky cases involving corrupt politicians and mobsters. So Pete Rose would not be his first rodeo. And within days, Dowd was interviewing a man who had intimate knowledge of Rose's gambling. And before you knew it, Dowd published a report spanning 9 volumes and 3,000 pages. Rose ended up being permanently banned from baseball, which was historic and profound. Now, looking over the Otani and Rose situations, consider the lack of consistency. MLB, they got in front of the Rose crisis while it's being pulled along by events in the Otani crisis. MLB controlled the Rose situation, and now it's being controlled by the Otani situation. MLB came down hard on Rose for his flipping on whether he bet, effectively his lying. Yet Major League Baseball doesn't even blink when Otani changes his storyline by 180 degrees within days. MLB wants it to be true, and maybe it is. But I've got serious doubts that Major League Baseball's official investigation of Otani will even come close to the intensity and thoroughness of Dowd's investigation of Rose. You sense MLB wanted to find truth with Rose, and it wants to avoid truth with Otani. Truth might be too damaging here in this situation. And how about Major League Baseball rules saying the gambling is evil and it will result in severe punishment, yet Major League Baseball has profitable deals with gambling platforms? And we're talking about $100 billion a year industry when it comes to sports wagering, constant listeners. Is that consistent? Is there any legitimate way for MLB to believe its players and teams and product and integrity are not at all being compromised by a gambling industry that is orders of magnitude larger than the Major League Baseball League itself? Oh, and one little factoid I didn't realize. Sports gambling, it's illegal in California. Now, that's weird to see something that's legal in 38 states still be illegal in anything goes California. So those bets made in Cali, they were illegal, just like Rose's were, no matter what the baseball rules say. Rose hasn't been quiet in this Otani debacle. Quiet isn't Pete Rose's thing. It never was. He commented on the controversy on social media, and it was vintage Pete Rose. The key soundbite was, "Well, back in the 70s and 80s, I wish I'd had an interpreter. I'd be scot-free." Rose, the Major League Baseball hit king, he has a point, people. And oh yes, Major League Baseball has a lack of consistency problem on its hands wrapped around this Otani saga. MLB doesn't want to know with Otani when it once did want to know with Rose. Because MLB realizes if it ends up knowing everything about the Otani saga, it just might end up being forced by its own rules and with its own Rose precedent to jettison the biggest star in the biggest of markets. Let's see what tomorrow brings and how Major League Baseball navigates this minefield. Now here's your host's easy and immediate fix as a stopgap. Reinstate Pete Rose and place him in the Hall of Fame. Don't punish him for something that looks like you may not have the stomach to punish others today for. It makes Major League Baseball look petty, and it exposes a lack of consistency. And it might help with Otani, depending on what comes out. And the second proposal, all sports teams, and all NCAA teams for that matter, should assume from this day forward that the inherent temptation and conflict of gambling, it's going to manifest and affect the integrity of the game. A presumption of cleanliness and integrity, that might not be warranted anymore. The gambling complex, just too large to firewall oneself from in sport. Yeah, now you see why the Otani Rose contrast with MLB. It's a great dedication subject for this episode and its theme of lack of consistency. Now, the nice thing about baseball is that even though the handling of gambling sagas may lack consistency, the scoring and player statistics, they require consistency. Issues with changing strike zones aside. And our next connection turns to something that presents an air of objective scoring consistency, standardized college entrance exam scores like the SAT, and it shows how the optics of consistent scoring hides an ugly truth of lack of consistency underneath. So let's explore. The standardized test exams for colleges, they're making a comeback. Yale and Dartmouth announced that they would start considering standardized test results once again after abandoning them during the pandemic. And when you don't consider test scores, the institution, the college, it's free to accept whoever it wants to using whatever subjective filters that it desires. And the college doesn't have to defend offering admission to someone scoring lower than another who was denied admission. It's perfection if you desire non-accountability, which is why colleges loved it. But there was a lot of pushback, so now standardized test scores are back, or at least being considered in the admissions process, which means now the stakes are once again high for scoring well on those tests, which means students, and read that as oftentimes rich kids in private schools, they're going to look to game the system to score higher, or the parents are going to collaborate with the students to do so. So let the gaming of the system begin. Teenagers are getting bogus ADHD diagnoses so they can have extra time in standardized test exams. When those Ivy League schools started taking scores again for admissions, guess what? Test takers with supposed ADHD afflictions, they're surging. Parents take students to doctors to lobby the physician for letters saying that the student has ADHD or something similar like anxiety or depression, and hoping that that will get them more time on the SATs, as it often does, as in as much as 50% more time. And that's, of course, a massively huge advantage, an unfair one if the student doesn't have the warranted condition. Standardized test experts and coaches say it can boost scores by hundreds of points. Oh yes, I would be remiss not to mention that all of these colleges who consider the standardized test scores, they're not informed which applicants had extra time or enjoyed other accommodations. It's like the old don't ask, don't tell situation that you used to see with the military. The colleges don't want to know, and the standardized test entities are happy to oblige and not tell them. It's a big game of pretend. Now, here are a few quotes from those close to the corrupt system. And I want to give props to Ricky Schlott, who wrote a great story on this that I was able to find these quotes for you from. Check her out if you can. The first quote is, "I get requests for ADHD testing accommodations all the time." And this was from a psychologist who continued, "Some parents are none too happy when I don't agree the child has ADHD." Then there was a parent of a student at an elite Manhattan prep school who said that out of her daughter's 8 closest friends, six of them have extra time on standardized tests. They were able to obtain the magic letter from a doctor, and the parent went on to say, quote, "They're getting really creative with it. It's ADHD or anxiety or depression that leads to migraines that supposedly disrupts the testing. It's not hyperbolic to say that almost everyone is doing it. Admissions are so cutthroat right now, and she's absolutely at a disadvantage without having extra time. But I'm self-made, and I'm not teaching my daughter to take any shortcuts in life." End quote. Hey, here's to a parent who's setting a great example for her child and for society. The CEO of a college counseling firm said that families are, using his number here, 1,000% manipulating the accommodations for unfair advantages. The CEO went on, "There are definitely unethical families out there who are trying to take advantage of the system. A student at a private school in Manhattan who all of a sudden gets an accommodation starting in 11th grade can look a little suspicious, because how do these kids get through school from kindergarten to 11th grade getting straight A's without needing any accommodations?" End quote. Yeah, that's a great question. But the colleges and standardized test companies, they're also complicit in this racket by setting up a process whereby this goes unchecked. And what about those doctors who are basically misdiagnosing on purpose? That's illegal and unethical. A high school math teacher at a private school estimated a third of his students got extra time and said some of their disability claims seemed bogus. That was the term he used. And then he went on, he said, "It's quite a racket. Educational psychologists rake in a pretty penny for diagnoses." End quote. The students know exactly what is going on and what example it sets. It's a tragedy, not of the commons, but it's a tragedy of the herd or peers, so to speak. One student put it this way, "The system was exploited for sure. More and more people got diagnosed as time went on because I think they realized it was just something they could do because everyone else was doing it." Now, some are speaking out to their credit The Learning Disabilities Association of America, in a statement, slammed people who abuse the system. They said in that statement, "These actions hurt all individuals with disabilities, including those with learning disabilities, by perpetuating the misconceptions that many students who obtain accommodations on college admissions do not have disabilities." I totally agree with that statement. Lack of consistency is alive and well, constant listeners, in areas such as standardized test scoring for college admissions. And they are presented, unfortunately, quite the contrary, as being quite consistent and objective. And I wrote about this crisis and this racket in higher ed in my book, Precipice, and it seems to be back bigger than ever today. The process needs a course correction quick. So far, we covered lack of consistency in a sport with its stars, as well as something with high stakes for students in college admissions and the tests that go with it, and who gets to enjoy the benefit of extra time. Let's jump to a connection where the stakes are even higher and impacts all of society, including you and me. Is the law consistently applied these days, or is it subjectively applied depending on who and the what? An intriguing and troubling topic. I want to discuss the judgment against President Trump for the alleged fraud in New York regarding his real estate valuations. The $454 million bond to appeal the ruling marks the highest bond ever recorded in United States history against a single individual for doing what some people's experience has shown all kinds of firms and banks engage in every day, which is negotiating and debating the value of assets to set loan levels and covenants. Shark Tank star Kevin O'Leary, he pointed out the ruling didn't go over well with the real estate industry that was now fretting over the possibility of being the next target. They should fret, and they will eventually be up next. Yeah, the precedent, it's a big problem based on industry norms. Now, the anti-Trump crowd says in response that President Trump was found liable for falsifying business records and financial statements, along with insurance fraud. The O'Leary view is, quoting O'Leary, "Everything that you just listed off is done by every real estate developer everywhere on earth in every city. This has never been prosecuted," end quote. And he's correct about that. Now, a disclaimer, constant listeners, I'm not looking to elevate President Trump to martyr status. I don't have a MAGA hat. I get why some people despise him. I did vote for him, but when voting for president, you currently have only two choices until we have a needed legitimate third party, which I wrote about and you can read on nickdeolias.com. So you got to make a choice. And I did. But no, it's not about liking or disliking Trump. That's the point, actually, of this connection. This is instead about whether the law applies to everyone consistently or whether the law gets selectively applied to those we don't care for. It's supposed to be and needs to be the former in America, but it's turning into the latter, I fear, and it may result in a tit-for-tat banana republic form of lawfare. That's not America. Now, this connection on lacking consistency and rule of law was recently highlighted by comedian Jon Stewart. Definitely not a MAGA guy, a well-established Trump hater. And he got into a debate about whether the Trump verdict and bond judgment was legitimate. And now Jon Stewart, he's facing backlash for what he said. There is a lack of consistency, constant listeners. So Stewart was arguing that Trump's civil real estate case overvaluing his properties was not victimless. His point was doing so denied other more deserving applicants for capital because there is theoretically only so much capital to go around. Okay, I get the view and the argument, although I'm not sure I agree with it, but I understand the premise. And Stewart went further by stating, quote, "The Attorney General of New York knew that Trump's property values were inflated because when it came time to pay taxes, Trump undervalued the very same properties." And then he added, "It was all part of a very specific real estate practice known as lying," end quote. So Stewart implies or hints that failing to declare a higher market value on a property while paying taxes based on a lower assessed value, that can constitute fraudulent behavior. Okay. But it turns out Stewart might have been practicing exactly what he was criticizing there. He lacked consistency between the two, his actions and his words. Stewart owned a pricey home in New York City, and the history of that home shows a few interesting details. First, it looks like Stewart ended up selling his home for over 8 times the assessed value of the home, assessed as in for tax purposes. In 2014, Stewart sold his Tribeca duplex for $17.5 million, but the property was market valued at only $1.9 million, and the actual assessor valuation was even lower at $850,000. So Stewart paid significantly lower property taxes, which were calculated based on that market value price, than he would have if taxes were based on the true market price that the property ended up selling for. And that's effectively what he called out Trump for doing and what he viewed as lying or fraud. Now, did Stewart commit fraud? Heck no, of course he didn't. Millions of Americans own homes that are assessed for property tax purposes at levels far below market value. If Stewart committed fraud, we're all committing fraud. In using Stewart's anti-Trump logic, paying less in property taxes due to an artificially low assessed value, that would deny government of needed tax revenue. Is that tax evasion or fraud? Of course it is not. We'd all be potentially liable for such. Now, since that house was in the New York Attorney General's jurisdiction, the one who went after Trump, should we expect a grand jury indictment of Stewart? Of course we shouldn't. But where is the consistency? Was Stewart's rhetoric defending the Trump judgment versus Stewart's own handling of his property, with the law being applied uniformly to all, no matter who you are or how likable or unlikable you might be? And what dangerous precedent does it set moving forward for lawfare that is lacking consistency? I shudder to think about where this pushes us toward. Let's start to wind down episode 154 of This Far Middle. We've been discussing lack of consistency from start to finish of this episode, so let's end on that topic. And let's find a fitting subject to focus on for that final connection. As I said, the first airing of this episode is on May 1st, and that marks the anniversary of the release of one of the greatest singles in the history of music by one of its brightest minds and one of its most inconsistent personalities. May 1st, 1956. That was the day when Johnny Cash released his iconic single, I Walk the Line. The song employs a unique chord progression, which was accidentally inspired by backwards playback of guitar runs on Cash's tape recorder while he was in the Air Force stationed in Germany. How about that? Now, the single went to number one. That was his first number one, and it started an epic run of one of this nation's greatest singer-songwriters and an individual who lacked consistency through much of his life. It was a roller coaster ride that would be an apt description of Johnny Cash's journey from rural America to the big lights in Nashville, from substance abuser to sober individual, from a rabble rouser to quiet family man. A lot of ups and downs, a lot of variety, and a lack of consistency. It's what makes for a fascinating story, that lack of consistency, even though it may not have been fun living it all of the time. And Johnny Cash has a nice connection to perhaps an even more inconsistent individual with a perhaps even greater career as a singer-songwriter, the one many consider the greatest singer-songwriter ever, and that would be the legendary Bob Dylan, because May 1st also marks the day, this time in 1969, when Bob Dylan recorded an appearance on the Johnny Cash Show in Nashville. After two solo numbers from Dylan, Johnny Cash joined him for a rendition of Girl from the North Country that became legend. Now, watch some of those old episodes of the Johnny Cash Show if you find the time. They are great entertainment. And through the history of the show, Cash had on his guests everyone from Neil Young to James Taylor to Ray Charles to Eric Clapton. I remember seeing Ray Charles sitting at the piano playing and singing I Walk the Line with Cash sitting next to him on Cash's show. And that's something to see. Now, Bob Dylan doesn't seem to care about consistency in life. He's performed thousands of times, and I would venture that no two shows are exactly the same. Musically, he went from acoustic folk to electric rock. He's gone from genres of folk to country to rock. He's been all over the religious spectrum, from Jewish to Christian to, I believe, at some point, periods of agnostic. He started on the East Coast in places like Greenwich Village and the clubs there, and he ended up living on the West Coast in Malibu. And I believe there's a Bob Dylan Greenwich Village walking tour that you can actually map out. Yeah, Dylan, he's an eclectic guy who lacks consistency, and that's what makes him great. So a lack of consistency isn't always a bad thing, constant listeners. But one consistent thing you can be sure of is another episode in a week. Bye for now.